for your commuters.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tens of thousands of protesters take to the streets of Genoa, Italy, as the eight richest nations in the world meet today. Today we'll go from global protest to local struggle.
Sustainable economic growth. We wanted our heritage area to be a tourist area. It should be a national park, not a national prison.
And in the Klamath River Basin, a complex local struggle on the border between Portland, Oregon, and California.
The Yurok depend on the river for salmon and other fisheries that depend on the river. And when the federal government took away our land and put us on a reservation, they guaranteed that we would always be able to provide for a livelihood.
From Genoa and the G8 Forum to the Klamath River in Oregon to the fields of rural Pennsylvania, we'll look at the local dimensions of global protest. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With police firing tear gas at demonstrators protesting corporate-led globalization and poverty, leaders of the seven wealthiest countries began their annual economic summit today, stressing their desire to keep the United States' economic slowdown from pushing the rest of the world into recession. The meetings being held under the tightest security of any of the previous 27 summits. A first day of protests yesterday, which drew 50,000 demonstrators, passed off peacefully, but some groups have vowed to try to break into the red zone today. This warning, a main body of tens of thousands of demonstrators began marching from a stadium towards the center of the city. We'll go there in just a few minutes. President George Bush met last night with British Prime Minister Tony Blair and praised him as a political ally willing to think anew about controversial U.S. plans to create a missile defense shield. Blair sidestepped questions about his support for abandoning the 1973 anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia, which would almost certainly involve upgrading radar stations in England. Meanwhile, a Greenpeace protester breached a high-security police no-fly zone outside the meeting, wearing a propeller-powered parachute and chased by police helicopters. The protesters circled the residence 10 times and unfurled a banner reading, "Greenpeace outlaws Bush," before being forced to land. A spokesperson said that Greenpeace has condemned Bush as a criminal and wants him to stay at home until he signs the Kyoto Protocol and gives up the Star Wars defense plans. Also during the meeting, which was held on the eve of the G8 Economic Summit in Genoa, the two leaders appealed for peaceful protest and insisted that wider global trade would benefit the world's poor. President Bush said, instead of embracing policies that help the poor, you embrace policies that lock poor people into poverty, and that is unacceptable in the United States. This news from Argentina. In one of the largest strikes in years, state workers paralyzed much of Argentina in an outpouring of disgust over a government austerity plan calling for salary cuts and pension reductions. Union leaders called the protest over government plans to slash spending by 13%, which is to include state worker salaries and pension cuts. Young protesters shouted no to economic austerity as they lit firecrackers outside the nation's stock exchange. The deficit-cutting measures have largely been welcomed by international investors who worry Argentina will default on its debt payments. With the nation in the grips of a three-year recession saddled with $130 billion in public debt, more than 10 million Argentines have been pushed into poverty, government statistics show. Crime and homelessness has also skyrocketed. Foreign ministers from the world's leading powers, including the United States, called yesterday for neutral international monitors to be allowed to observe the shattered Middle East truce, delivering a diplomatic setback to Israel. The idea, long high on the Palestinian agenda, has consistently been opposed by Israel, whose Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, swiftly rejected it again. In a communique issued before today's opening of the G8 conference in Genoa, the foreign minister said they believe third-party monitoring would help the implementation of the Mitchell peace plan. The plan is still on ice because Israel is demanding a total end to Palestinian violence before moving ahead. Meanwhile, three Palestinians, including a baby, were shot dead near Hebron last night, adding weight to reports that a group of Jewish guerrillas has begun operating in the West Bank. Israel Radio reported that a militant settler organization called the Road Safety Group said it was responsible, a claim which, if true, makes this the worst attack by Israeli civilians on Arabs in 10 months of low-level war in the occupied territories. Militant settlers in the West Bank have stoned and shot Palestinians in the past. They've also burnt crops and stores, vandalized vehicles, and smashed windows. The Israeli armed forces often make little effort to intervene. Vigilante patrols of settlers who have been demanding that their Prime Minister Ariel Sharon unleash his army against Palestinians have also been sighted. Sarah Dash, Nona Hendricks, Cindy Birdsong, and Patricia Louise Holt, a.k.a. Patti LaBelle. That's Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells singing You'll Never Walk Alone here on Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. Tens of thousands of protesters have taken over the streets of Genoa, Italy, as the Group of Eight Industrial Nations begin their annual meeting today. G8 leaders are meeting to discuss the economic slump that has brought economic growth in much of the world to a halt. But aides to the presidents and prime ministers of the world's richest countries say they're unlikely to pay attention to calls from poorer nations for new initiatives on debt relief or development. One Malaysian newspaper commenting on the meeting denounced the policies of the G8 as a peaceful slaughter of poorer countries and condemned their, quote, reluctance to pursue equitable and responsible global solutions to economic and social problems. It might be easier for leaders of the world's richest nations to hear the voices of the poor if they weren't being kept out by the 20-foot-high iron barriers that surround the old city where the meeting is taking place. Nearly 20,000 heavily armed police are patrolling Genoa, large parts of which have been completely shut down, while missile launchers ring Genoa's airport. Yesterday, an estimated 30,000 people marched peacefully through the streets calling for open borders for immigrants and carrying signs that read, "No nations, no borders, and the world is not for sale. Throw the bankers in jail." We go now to the streets of Genoa, where Laurent Jezevere is standing by. He is with Attac France. Can you tell us what the scene is like on the street? Laurent, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Can you tell us where you are and what's happening?
Yes, I am in the center of the city, in a Piazza Dante, in fact, in two Piazza Dante and Piazza Carigiano. We are just by the wall and just by the red zone, where the demonstration is taking place with a few thousand people. We're doing the demonstration as the rule of the GSF, is to say, we're banging on the wall, yelling, chanting, dancing, and everything. And as far as that is going on, I mean, our plan to invade the red zone by the air was successful. Our balloons, 5,000 of them, flew over to the to the G8 with our message and everything like half an hour ago. So everything is fine where I am, actually.
And Roberto Bui with Yabasta in Italy, you were in Quebec City for the FTAA protests as well. Right now, where are you?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
We have another guest on the phone, Laurent. Roberto Bui, are you there?
No, there's no barricade where I am. The barricade is a bit more in the east of in the east part of the city, where besides the city or the police blockades, there is some groups that are in fact, we have a black bloc of 300 persons that is in fact going from street to street and smashing windows and things like that. But I think the police is handling it. And as far as the Tutti Bianchi Yabasta, they have been stopped by the police and going down to the convention center, in fact, to try to help us to tame down the black bloc for them to not storm our convention center. So the city is it's moving a lot, but for the moment the things are pretty good.
We spoke to you just a few days ago, Laurent. Can you tell us, though, why you're there today? Here today, the opening day of the G8. For listeners who didn't hear about what was going on in the last few days, and what kind of messages are being put out in Italy, in the Italian media, which is basically all owned by the new prime minister, Berlusconi, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We want to say to the richest men club, in fact, or the richest countries club, as you wish to call them, we want them to say that we don't recognize them as a ruling power as far as the G8 is going on, and we're asking them if they realize to realize in an agenda that is, in fact, in sync with what the people want. There's been several polls that have been going on for newspapers in Europe, in Greece, France, England, Germany, and, for example, the last one in France showed that 63% of the population is in favor of our movement and our demands. The same in Greece and the same, from what I know, in Germany, I'm sorry, and in England. So what we're telling them is that, actually, we don't want them to reannounce again. We want them, if they want them to really talk about matters that regarding the world, well, to listen to the people, and to stop doing this policing by above, and to doing a bit listening to what the people want.
We are now going to go to Megan, who is with the group Globalize Resistance from Britain, who is inside a convergent space at the moment. Megan, can you describe where you are?
Yes, I'm in the main convergence center, the Genoa Social Forum, which is an umbrella group of about 800 international organizations who've organized these protests, has set up as a safe space for people, as where people with children and people can get accommodation and so on. And at the moment, we're penned in by several thousand police who probably about an hour ago invaded the convergence center and fired tear gas into the convergence center and have bulldozed down some barricades which were at the front of the center.
Can you talk about the red zone?
In the sense of the protests or in the sense of what it is?
Just what it is. Outside, we know nothing about, Joe.
Okay, sure. The red zone is effectively what's happened is hundreds of thousands of demonstrators from all over the world and all over Italy really have made most of Genoa their own. The red zone really is the area that the police have sealed off, the center of the city in order to protect the leaders of the G8 nations while they have their summit. And the red zone has been impassable for anybody, whether an inhabitant of Genoa or a protester, so that it is actually not possible to democratically protest outside the leaders, our elected leaders of our own nation. The police have made that impossible. The red zone is a secure area for the richest the representatives of the richest nations in the world.
The Genoa Social Forum, Megan, can you explain what that is?
Certainly, yes. The Genoa Social Forum is a collective which extraordinarily has pulled together something like 800 different organizations ranging from Jubilee South, Drop the Debt, prayer groups, Christian groups, right through to ATTAC in France, the campaign against to enforce corporation tax, through to socialists and anarchists and so on. And it really is a very broad spectrum, which has managed to organise a huge number of demonstrations and to mobilise a fantastic number of people onto the streets, people who also are not involved in any of those organisations, but it has managed to democratically decide and organise those protests.
Finally, can you tell us the plans for this weekend, since this is the first day of the G8 Forum?
Yes, that's right. Yesterday, you spoke to somebody before who talked about the huge demonstration to defend immigrant rights, which was fantastically important, and obviously we've had today. Tomorrow, really, I think, is the most centrally important demonstration, where we're expecting up to 150,000 trade unionists to join the Genoa Social Forum to march in favour of trade union rights and against the privatisation of the world.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Megan, with Globalized Resistance, one of the tens of thousands of protesters who are at the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy. And as we move now from globalization abroad to local issues at home, we'll just take a bit of a music break before we go to the introduction.
Let's just say it's the end of an age. Time to start building a new one.
The protests in Genoa are being coordinated by hundreds of organizations around the world. We often forget that the struggle against corporate-led globalization is composed of thousands of local struggles. And today, for the rest of the program, we're going to look at two of those struggles, one on the border between California and Oregon, and the other in a rural town in Pennsylvania. We'll begin out west. Over the past several weeks, family farmers in the Klamath Basin on the Oregon-California border have been engaging in an unusual tactic, civil disobedience. On four separate occasions, they've cracked open an irrigation headgate, and on Sunday, 100 farmers placed a pump in the upper Klamath Lake and ran irrigation pipe 2 football fields long, sending water down the irrigation canal that's been dry since April. That was when the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation shut off water supplying 90% of the land in the Klamath Project to save endangered suckerfish in Upper Klamath Lake and threaten coho salmon in the Klamath River. Drought conditions mean there's not enough water for both fish and farmers. Since the water was shut off, farmers have been forced to sell off cattle, let pastures and hay fields go brown, and give up annual plantings of potatoes, grain, and other crops. Some farmers are facing bankruptcy and foreclosure. The acts of disobedience have been largely symbolic, as many farmers' crops are already dead. Sympathetic law enforcement officials have declined to arrest anyone, but the situation escalated last week when U.S. Marshals came in for the first time to guard the irrigation project. The media has painted the controversy as a battle between farmers and fish, jobs versus the environment. But both fishermen and Native Americans have sided with the government's decision to shut off the water. According to the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the Klamath River salmon runs have been reduced to less than 10% of their original size, and thousands of people have been put out of work. And the federal action marks the first time that Native Americans, who once depended on the fish for food, have won out over farmers on water allocation since the irrigation system known as the Klamath Project began in 1907. We're going to go to our break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by three people, executive director of the Yurok tribe, a fisherman, as well as a farmer, to talk about what this struggle really is. Then in the last segment of the program, we'll go to rural Pennsylvania, to Wayne County, where a community is fighting the building of a federal prison on their land. They say they'd rather be a federal park than a federal prison. You're listening to Democracy Now! In this special on globalization from Genoa, Italy to Oregon, California, and Pennsylvania. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Farmers, fishermen, Native Americans, a struggle for a most valuable resource, water. Today we turn to three people on the border of Oregon and California. A farmer whose farm is at risk and who's one of the original organizers of the Acts of Disobedience, where more than 100 farmers placed a pump in the upper Klamath Lake and ran an irrigation pipe 200 yards long, sending water down an irrigation canal that has been dry since April. We'll speak to the executive director of the Yurok Tribe and the Northwest Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations about what this struggle is all about. But let's begin with Mike Connolly, cattle and hay farmer and a member of the Klamath Watershed Council. Can you tell us how this controversy came about and what's happened so far?
What I find fascinating, first of all, about the situation is how it has demonstrated a promise that was talked about early on in environmentalism about how it transcends traditional political distinctions. And I find it bizarre that on the right you have conservative war veterans talking about, you know, flag burning and engaging in civil disobedience. And on the left you have environmentalists describing themselves as law and order advocates and encouraging blind obedience to the coercive domestic policies of the most powerful and rapacious government in the history of the industrial nation state. So it's a pretty strange situation going on out here. My involvement in the protest was more central early on. We had a tractor rally at the offices of Fish and Wildlife and Reclamation. And really as the protest sort of escalated, I sort of lost my ability to engage the situation, because as most people know, when you have a crisis situation, it empowers the extremes, and that's really what's kind of happened here on both sides. And those of us who have spent the last decade or so working to sort of chart out that common ground between interest groups have been marginalized.
Let me bring Glenn Spain into the conversation, Northwest Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, representative of the downriver commercial fishing industry. Can you explain the history of the Klamath River project?
Well, the Klamath River Irrigation Project was started in 1907 and it gradually expanded for many decades to take more and more of the water in the upper river. Unfortunately, in that era, there was sort of a make the deserts bloom kind of Western migration mandate, and the Bureau of Reclamation did its job. It expanded the project and took as much of the water as it could and gave it to the farms. You know, farmers are sort of innocent victims here. They were promised water that really wasn't there because nobody had even considered that there would be a limit on what the ecosystem could tolerate in terms of water diversions. And right now we have a deeply distressed ecosystem. It's not just one species, but it's a whole bunch of species in a very, very fragile and unique ecosystem. That are in distress, and it's primarily because there's been too much water taken out of the river, and our industry is one of those that is river-dependent. We have a lot of jobs, thousands of jobs, that depend on fish in the river, and in order to have fish, you have to have water. I think our friend from the farming community is right on the money. That ecosystem management has to be applied, and not species by species management, but that's what we have here, is an ecosystem in dire distress. The other problem, of course, is that the Bureau foresaw this. This wasn't sudden. It was a sudden cutoff because this is the worst drought in the project's history. You know, one-third of the nation is in severe drought, and this is one of the hardest-hit places. But the Bureau saw this coming for years, because they'd not really planned for what to do if there were those kinds of intense competitions, and did nothing, dragged its feet and encouraged people to be in denial. Right now, of course, they're doing what they can to augment with groundwater. About a quarter of the needs of the project now can be supplied with emergency groundwater. We should have been doing that 20 years ago, and then we wouldn't have this. We should have all worked together to augment the supply, and we wouldn't have this, and also to reduce the demand to sustainable levels, and we wouldn't have these kind of conflicts. The comment that the moderates have been marginalized is right on the money. A lot of these protests, a lot of the extremists on both sides, are disrupting a mediation process that is probably the longest or the best long-term hope for this. And the moderates have been marginalized, and they are still there. We are still there. A lot of people in the farm community are still there trying to find out what we can do in the long run to make this kind of conflict impossible.
Why the sudden cutoff of water in April to 90% of the land in the Klamath Project?
Well, it is a sudden cutoff because there was a sudden drought. This year, you have to understand, is less than one-third the normal rainfall of only 12 inches a year on the average. That is technically a desert. And trying to divvy up water in an over-appropriated system with too many competing uses chasing too little water in a drought year is extremely stressful. And that's essentially where we are today.
We should also mention, Glenn, that both the requirements from the agencies for the salmon and the suckerfish were fairly dramatically increased this year in conjunction with the drought situation.
Well, the warning signs were there for anybody to see, and there was a plan, a recovery plan in 1992 and 93 that was never implemented, partly because Congress never saw fit to fund it.
I want to bring Troy Fletcher into the conversation, executive director of the Yukon Tribe. The federal action, the shutting off of the water, marks the first time that salmon fishermen and the Klamath tribes, who once depended on the fish for food, have won out over farmers on water allocations. Can you talk about the significance of the area for your tribe?
The Yurok Tribe is located at the mouth of the Klamath River. The Yurok Reservation extends from the Pacific Ocean upstream 44 miles. And so you can see that anything that happens in the entire Klamath Basin, the Yurok have an interest in. The Yurok depend on the river for salmon and other fisheries that depend on the river. And when the federal government took away our land and put us on a reservation, they guaranteed that we would always be able to provide for a livelihood. Now, I do differ with some of the comments that I have heard. You know, I believe Mike had indicated that agriculture was completely cut off. Well, they weren't. They still are receiving some water, albeit greatly reduced. And, you know, what the government did this year was necessary, it was just, and it didn't just happen. The scientific and technical evidence has been out there and has been developing over a number of years. There have been a number of solicitor opinions and legal court decisions that have all pointed to this day. We've just been fortunate in the past few years that we haven't had a drought of the magnitude we've had this year. And because of this drought, the government, by law, by mandates, had to make the decisions that they made. And it wasn't something that people didn't know were coming. It wasn't sudden. So, you know, this is something we could have prevented, but that's old news. Now we need to work on a solution to resolve the issues here.
And what do you think is a solution, Troy Fletcher?
Well, I think number one is that, as Glenn had indicated, and as Mike had indicated, we need to reduce demand, but then we also need to reduce demand because we have too great of a demand on a limited supply, but then we also need to work on a sustainable system. We need to get away from single species management, and from our perspective, there has got to be sufficient water to protect salmon resources.
Do you have hope in the current mediation process that's taking place?
I guess we have hope in a whole bunch of different processes that are taking place. The current mediation process, we're going to commit 100% to doing whatever we can to try to work toward a resolution. I have hope that habitat restoration projects that the tribe and other groups have initiated will be a benefit to the resource. I have hope that the restoration and the good projects that the farming community are embarking on are going to
benefit us. So I think there's this is the best chance we've had in a long time, from my perspective, to reach a solution. It's much better to sit down at a table and work it out versus litigation.
Do you think
nobody
that,
wins?
Do you think the government was right in completely shutting off the water, or 90% of the water, in April?
Well, the government had no other choice. I mean, we have a you know, fish species in the Klamath River at the brink of extinction. That is what the Endangered Species Act is an alarm for. They had no other choice. And our people, the Yurok people, have had a tremendous economic and cultural impact because of years and years, decades of the way the river's been managed. While it was terrible what happened to the farming community, that was just 1 year. We've had an ongoing decline of fishery populations, many of which have gone extinct already.
Let me bring Mike Connolly back into the conversation. Your response to Troy Fletcher, executive director of the Yurok Tribe.
I need to say that this is not something that we have just embarked on, and it is not, we have not been in denial. For 10 years, we have been, many of us have been working our tails off trying to address this situation from an ecosystem perspective and not with single species management.
Yeah,
down in Arcata talking to people, it became very clear that the general conception was that we have been sitting on our hands up here doing absolutely nothing. And this really gets to me, you know, to the point that most frustrates me, is that even if we all agree on the science that's been presented to justify these decisions, that's where you really see the shame in this, because what was happening in the basin is the emergence of these collaborative community-based efforts that people all across the West have recognized are the real and ultimate effective solution to these things. And the way the regulatory hammer has come down this year has been devastating to those processes.
Yeah, let me come in on that. Mike is absolutely correct, and I don't want to give the impression that there is universal denial. The problem with denial in the Upper Basin has primarily been the Bureau of Reclamation. The Bureau of Reclamation has never really considered a long-range horizon. You know, they have never had a long-range plan. They lurch along on an annual plan and have been doing that for years and years. They were never really scoping out how much water was available and planning for drought. Their only drought plan is who gets cut off first. They're now having to backfill and tap groundwater and talk about storing more water and these things, but, you know, it's too little too late for the farmers this year. As to the science, I've heard a lot of creative arguments, many of them very convoluted, as to why fish don't need water. The science that is on the table is very solid, and, you know, there may be people who disagree with the science, but the scientific community has looked at it thoroughly, and we're doing the best we can with limited information. I think that's important. The reality is that we only have a limited amount of water to go around, and that the whole system has been designed to use more than is really there. And frankly, all the political posturing, all the radical organizing, all the press releases, all the marches in the world will not create more rain. That is really the bottom line.
Troy Fletcher of the Yurok Tribe. Last week, the Pacific Legal Foundation filed a formal petition with Interior Secretary Gail Norton and Commerce Secretary Don Evans, urging a convening of the seldom-used Endangered Species Committee, a cabinet-level seven-member panel commonly called the God Squad, to overrule the water shutoff that's affected 1,400 farms and 200,000 acres. What is your response to that?
Well, I have a couple of responses. The first is we're glad that the administration recently denied that petition. They denied it on procedural grounds that the petitioners didn't have standing to bring that petition forward. Additionally, just last week, we testified in front of the Senate Natural Resource Committee for the state legislature of California, and we made it clear to them, along with the commercial fishermen and some environmental groups, that we made it clear to the committee, and we've made it clear to the government, and the government agrees that
even if the ESA were gutted or set aside, which would be terrible, the government still has legal mandates to protect the tribe's reserved fishing and water rights. So we would still be looking at the same science. We would still reach the same decision. We'd still have the same debate and discussion. It would probably be a little more focused because we wouldn't be blaming the ESA for all the terrible things that are happening in the, you know, to the farming community.
The ESA being?
The Endangered Species Act. So it really, you know, I think much of the debate has really been misfocused, and we need to, instead of, you know, I think we do have moderates on the phone here. I think, you know, Mike and Glenn and myself are all willing to roll our sleeves up and try to resolve the problem. And you know, all the debate and discussion about whether you amend the Endangered Species Act really is a moot point when you look at the reserve fishing rights.
Troy Fletcher, do you think that this problem can be resolved without sacrificing the livelihoods of farmers?
I think that this problem can be resolved. I think that there will have to be a reduction in the overall demand. I think that's a reality, and that's something that the farming community will have to face and will have to deal with. And I'd like to say it's something that we've had to deal with on an ongoing basis over decades. The Yurok Reservation, 80% of it is without electricity or telephone service. We have some of the highest unemployment and poverty rates in the state of California. So it's real difficult when we talk about the poorest of the poor stories. I can tell you that the Yurok tribe will win that one. We don't want to win that one. We can't win that one. And so we're willing and we're looking forward to resolving the issues.
Mike Connolly, your own farm, what's the situation now?
I'm within that 10% that has water. I'm on, although we go from day to day, there's a lawsuit pending currently from an environmental group here in Oregon to try and get our water too and pump it through a mountain into another watershed. I'm the last guy on the river that has water. The guy right next door to me is dried up. So we're directly experiencing this situation. Plus the impacts, the collateral impacts on the economy are making it very difficult for us to make our operation work. Now, you know, one of the things that Troy said, that behind the ESA is the tribal trust obligations. And I just like to say that I'd much rather work within the context of tribal trust obligations than the Endangered Species Act. And I just don't agree with the contention that the Endangered Species Act is not a part of this problem. I think it is really at the center of this problem, in part because of what I said earlier, that because the law was written 10 years before there was any such thing as collaborative community-based conservation efforts. Since the act was written, you've had these sorts of efforts emerge throughout the West, and the law is just not written to deal with those. So when I talk about how the ESA needs to be amended and how it's part of the problem here, it's because it's not just a parallel process to these community-based processes. It's matter, and the collaborative process are antimatter. And what this year has demonstrated is when those two clash, the community-based processes get obliterated. Now, you know, we had said that we have three moderates on the phone, but I think there's another thing that we all have in common. We all derive our sustenance, or would like to anyway, from the resources of the watershed. And a lot of my resentment in this situation is directed not so much towards the fishermen and the tribes, but with the environmental groups who are positioned between us in such a way that it keeps us fighting with each other. And the agencies play a role in that, too. And the Endangered Species Act makes that possible.
Glenn Spain, do you agree?
No, I don't. Let me be clear, by the way. The environmentalists have played a role in this because they've been a warning sound for about 10 or 15 years on some of these problems. But it was commercial fishermen struggling for their livelihoods and struggling to make sure that there were any jobs at all in their ports that brought the original lawsuit that set all this in motion. It isn't a fish versus people kind of dynamic at all. It's much more complex than that. There is a place there will always be a place for voluntary and community-based efforts to try to get ahead of these problems. But unfortunately, in spite of leadership in the basin, such as Mike's and Mike Staunton and a whole bunch of other folks who've been working on these things, the agencies themselves put a kibosh to a lot of this, and there was too little too late for this drought year. Next year, we all pray that there will be more water and there will be less pressure. I think we can still make a lot of progress, but one of the things that, is important is to realize that species don't go on the list just willy-nilly. They go on the list because they're near endangerment or extinction. And those are warning signs that something is seriously wrong, that a system is overstressed and overtaxed. And we, I think, all owe it to ourselves and to our communities and to our people and to each other to work together to try to resolve these things so that we don't have to be here forever.
What is the best way to get information about, well, your perspective on this struggle that's going on right now on the Oregon-California border? Troy Fletcher, is there a place on the web or a phone number people can call? How can they get information?
We don't have a place on the web, but people can call me at my work, which is 707-444-0433, and we have you know, a whole bunch of written material on this particular issue, and would be happy to share it with anybody.
And Glenn Spain,
best is to go to our website, www.pcffa.org.
And Mike Connolly,
there is a website covering the current crisis at www.klamathbasincrisis.org. And people are also welcome to contact me for information more oriented towards the collaborative efforts that are going on.
Could I make a comment to the moderator here?
Yes.
I really appreciate this kind of effort. A lot of the talk shows that we've all participated have been yelling matches, and that just doesn't do a whole lot of good. I think a thoughtful discussion like this is really helpful. And I am also worried, just as Mike is, that the middle ground, the moderates, have been undercut from both extreme sides. I think we all are working to make sure that we're heard.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Glenn Spain, Northwest Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. Mike Connolly, cattle and hay farmer with the Klamath Watershed Council. And Troy Fletcher, Executive Director of the Yurok Tribe. You are listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The people of Canaan Township in rural Pennsylvania never ask the Federal Bureau of Prisons to come to town. They never ask them to confiscate their land or ruin the streams that run nearby so they could build a prison for inmates who can no longer be housed in Washington, D.C.'s overflowing criminal justice system. But the Bureau of Prisons came anyway. And the people of Wayne County said no and fought back. 2.5 years later, this little town in Pennsylvania is still fighting. What happened to Canaan Township in Wayne County is by now a familiar story. Prison construction in rural areas is a booming industry, and many struggling towns around the country have reluctantly embraced prisons in a last-ditch attempt at economic revival.
But the response of Canaan Township to the siren song of prison construction is not familiar, and opposition to the prison has forged unusual alliances, most recently among trout fishermen and farmers outraged at the destruction of local waterways as construction gets underway. Mary Denise Malloy joins us now. She's a registered nurse, a farmer, and a member of the Organization of Concerned Citizens of Wayne County. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be asked to speak out.
Well, this story, as we were saying, is not so unfamiliar, the story of what happens to a town when a prison comes in. But I was wondering, in your situation, if you can describe what happened. Give us the chronology of events. When did the Federal Bureau of Prisons come to you?
I would say about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, was the first time that I was aware a prison was going to be put in Canaan Township, a federal prison. And the rumors that came to me were that people were losing their homes. I didn't correlate exactly what that meant. I was kind of confused. I started to ask questions at our regularly scheduled public meetings. Our township meetings are held each month. And the answers that I was getting made me even more confused. I didn't think it made sense to put prisons where people already lived and farmed. So that was the first time that I was brought into the issue and that I spoke out. I'm unaware of anything prior to that. So I spoke out at public meetings. People were losing their homes. We've lost 7 families from Canaan Township. A working farm in dairy production was closed down deliberately to place this prison. Agricultural land, which was highly protected by Pennsylvania environmental law, historically significant land, approximately 1,000 acres, has been seized by the U.S. government as we speak right now.
What do you mean by historically significant land?
Well, the D&H Railroad, as started, was the Gravity Railroad. The Lackawanna County, which is adjacent to Wayne County in northeastern Pennsylvania, literally fueled the Industrial Revolution by sending anthracite coal via the Gravity Railroad to the canals in Honesdale and there on into New York City. So the historic significance has been detailed by the National Registry in Washington, D.C. The National Park Service also contemplates helping us to turn these lands into a national park area. So this was a heritage handed down in this area, and we were all stewards of it in Canaan Township for this century. It was so astonishing and shocking that this was the site of the prison. It really set the community back on its heels. But foremost, people actually lost their homes. Working farmland in production was shut down. So that's how I became a part of the Organization of Concerned Citizens. We formed a group of people, neighbors, friends. Actually, the people that formed this group didn't know each other. We were the people that asked questions at the township meetings, and none of us were satisfied with the answers we received. So after the meetings, we would kind of mill around and start to talk to each other. We realized we had to organize and give ourselves a name so that we could be an entity that the Federal Bureau of Prisons would have to deal with. We started to meet each Monday night. We have met each Monday night for the last 2.5 years. I'm very proud of that record. I found out that it's very unusual for that to be able to be that standard. So that's where we are today. We did research. We fought. We're still angry. We can't understand how this has happened to us.
We asked the Federal Bureau of Prisons to join us. They refused, but I assume what they would say is that they bought the land from local people.
None of these properties that sold were for sale before the Federal Bureau of Prisons knocked on their door.
Did they say they were going to condemn the land?
Yes, yes. I spoke to a number of people of the 7 families, and yes, they were told that they would condemn the land. So that's how it happened that people were moved out of their homes. So that's how it happened. They were told they had no choice. And when they sought legal advice, they were told you know, you might as well move on. You can't win a battle with the federal government. So that's how they happened to move out of their homes.
How did your township council, I don't know what local governing entity you have, but how did it respond to the prison coming in?
Well, they responded by saying that they wanted it, that they asked for it to be put here, that it was the best thing that was ever going to happen. It was going to provide anyone that wanted a job with a job. They just praised it. They didn't even want to answer any questions that had a negative connotation. When questions were raised, when people did start to turn out in large numbers at the township meeting, we had officials from the municipal government at county level speak out and tell us that the questions we were asking were not appropriate ones. The federal government already had taken over the land, which was a lie then. It was a lie until a few months ago. So we were harassed. We were shouted down. It was very confusing. It brought about a fear and an intimidation that, you know, I had never witnessed in my life. Initially, there were minders, I call them, set down in the community that attended every meeting. Wherever two people gathered, these people were there, and they worked for the Federal Bureau of Prisons to monitor the township to see who was who, you know, who would be willing to speak out, who wouldn't take what they were told as the truth all the time. So it was kind of an infiltration process. The people that were in office, many of them are still in office, wanted this prison, and still to this day, even with all the problems that have become visible with it, they still say they want the prison and jobs will come here. We've proven there will be no jobs for local people with this prison, but they still, it's a mantra that they live by.
What about the prisoners who will come to your community in this prison from Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think that's one of the saddest aspects of the placement of this prison here. It's probably about 400-mile drive to Washington, D.C. from this area. Having worked in a prison as a prison nurse for 3 years, I understand the hardships that families have to visit the person that they care about, a family or a friend. So it will be a hardship for families, and I think that it will be more difficult for prisoners to rehabilitate in any way if there's more stress on their families.
And the environmental issues involved with the building of the prison in your community?
The environmental issues are now becoming overwhelming for the Bell Construction Company. There has been criminal charges placed against Bell Construction for the negligence, and I would call it more than negligence. I'd say it was aggressive conduct on part of Bell Construction, which is the primary engineering firm on site. There are others also. Their permits allowed them to do things in a certain sequence. They, you know, didn't care whether they followed that sequence or not. And as a result, you know, trout fishing is destroyed in the western half of the county. It was an industry that brought in a lot of money to Wayne County. It provided good quality of life, leisure time activities, and now it's gone, and that's outrageous.
Why? How did it get destroyed?
Well, what the construction firms did was to strip off the topsoil of over 500 acres. Now, these were hay fields in current production, and they just stripped them off, and so the silt or the dirt, topsoil, as it were, which has particles of clay in it in this part of the country, just flowed with the next rainfall into the tributaries and streams and creeks and rivers that flow from this area to the Delaware River, which is 25 miles away. These streams are in Wayne County are pristine. They're stocked regularly with trout, and fishing is a real benefit to the area. And the silt and clay flowed unimpeded down into the tributaries and destroyed the trout stocking, and also destroyed adult fish with too much sediment. Fish breathe through their gills, and they couldn't get enough oxygen. So we've had terrible destruction, outrageous. outrageous environmental destruction, which can't be corrected. So we've already lost a lot of our natural resources due to this prison siting.
We're doing a program today on globalization, you know, the large international protests that are taking place, and then local community struggles.
Right.
And I'm wondering just how you ended up becoming such an activist. You're a nurse. In fact, weren't you a nurse in a prison?
I was a nurse in a prison for 3 years, a state prison.
And with coming to it with that perspective, how does that affect your view of this?
Well, it really does. I have many friends who still work in prison. But I found it a dispiriting job. I feel, as a human being guarding another human being, it didn't give me any satisfaction at all. I saw the sadness of people in prison, and long sentences take away all your hope, really. I didn't see what I would call true rehabilitation with long sentences in prison. It was very dispiriting. And it kind of eats away at you. That's the way I felt. And I think when people say that they have prison jobs and they're good jobs, I think that maybe they're in some sort of denial about it. But as I say, I know many good people that work in prison, but that was my feeling about it. I think that it's a dispiriting job.
In a lot of communities, they welcome prisons because it revives an economically depressed area. Why has Wayne County, why in your area do you see it differently?
Well, one of the reasons probably is because we already have a prison here in Canaan Township. We have a state prison here. Prior to the institution becoming a state prison, it was a hospital for the criminally insane. It was a beautiful Gothic structure that sat up on top of Harvey Mountain. It was a well-respected place throughout this entire century. In the late 1980s, it was turned into a state correctional facility. And we haven't seen any kind of economic boom stemming from that prison. We already have a prison.
Denise Malloy, we want to thank you very much for being with us as we come to the end of the program. Denise Malloy with Concerned Citizens of Wayne County. I want to thank you very much. And finally, today, the Douglas Fisher Project and others have called for a national boycott and day of action in front of Best Buy stores. The day is in commemoration of the death of Douglas Fisher, the son of Democracy Now! Technical Director Errol Maitland. 6 years ago today, Best Buy employees chased Douglas Fisher, who's African-American, out of the store into a parking lot, put him in a chokehold, and killed him. They suspected him of using a fraudulent credit card. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Their groundbreaking work. Then a Friday morning special on Dance in L.A. The Dance Kaleidoscope performance this weekend is one of the biggest dance events of the year, with performers from most leading dance companies in the city. And as it turns out, Los Angeles has very good dancers. That's our Friday morning special on Dance in L.A., plus all the news from around town and around the world. That's how we're spending our Friday morning. We hope you'll join us, 8 a.m., right here on listener-sponsored KPFK Los Angeles.
This is 90.7 FM KPFK.